Hi, I'm Carmen LaBerge. Here's the podcast for Connecting Faith. Enjoy the conversation.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
Hello, friends. Welcome to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Thank you for joining me here today as we seek to take the headline news of the day, apply the mind of Christ, and prepare ourselves to enter into the conversations of the day in ways that honor Jesus. So let's just lead off with some of what you just heard in SRN News at the top of the hour. Horrible news today out of Genoa, Italy, where a massive span of a highway connecting Italy to France collapsed in obviously what they're talking about is structural failure. I mean, I think that's sort of obvious, no matter what ultimately, shook. We don't really know what caused this bridge to collapse. It's massive, though. And there's video of it. My heart just goes out to not only the more than 25 people who are now confirmed dead, that number is expected to rise. But all of the people who, you know, will just now live in fear of driving over bridges. And I remember when I was fairly young, I grew up in Tampa, Florida, and I remember vividly the day that a barge struck one of the pillars that was holding up what was then the Skyway Bridge. And that is a span of bridge across a beautiful expanse of water south of Tampa, actually south of Sarasota, that connects that part of Florida to southern Florida or South Florida. And the reality of cars plunging into the water and the helplessness of people leaping from their vehicles, trying to get other people to stop. Cause you really, it's hard to warn people that a bridge is out. Like that's one of the most difficult things to warn people, is ahead. So I guess, in terms of entering into the conversation, obviously like on many days, I'm going to encourage us to pray the news. I'm going to encourage us to pray for the first responders. I'm going to encourage us to pray for those who are directly involved. But many or most of us, the overwhelming majority of us, are in no way, shape, or form involved. And yet, every single day we put our faith in things like bridges. Every single day we put our faith in the drivers around us. Every single day we put our faith in lots of structures and I think that it's an opportunity to have conversations about just that. What are all the things that people put their faith in? And have they also put their faith in the faithfulness of God, who's not only real, but good and redemptive and can take even this and love people through it and carry people through it and hold them together in the midst of it as literally the world feels like, I think for some folks, it's falling down around them. Let's move to the story out of Nebraska that was also covered in the news at the top of the hour. This is, I think, equally difficult subject matter for us to roam around in as Christians, as believers, and yet it's important. Nebraska has carried out its first execution in more than two decades. They did so by lethal injection of a drug combination that will probably be the lead of this story in many news outlets as it's being discussed. The conversation will be about the mixture of drugs and where the drugs came from and whether or not products produced by a drug company can be used for an intent that they do not support. So in this case, a German drug company did not want their drugs used as a part of a lethal combination in an execution by lethal injection. I'm actually not going to say the name of the person who was executed, and I have a particular motivation for that. This is a man who faced execution dates by the Nebraska Supreme Court on seven different occasions over the last 20 years since he committed the crimes of murder for which he was convicted and sentenced to death. Each time those execution dates were delayed because of legal challenges and questions over whether previous lethal injection drugs could be used. And so for the relatives of his victims, I'm not going to say his name. because what these people have been saying in the media over and over and over again is, we would really like for our dad or our son, Maynard Hegland, his three children. Maynard Hegland was one of the victims who lost his life to this perpetrator. And Maynard Hegland's three children would like for their father's murderer to not be remembered. They would like for this to go away. And I think that that is part of the conversation that we have to have when we're talking about criminal justice and criminal justice reform in the United States of America. It is not insignificant that the person executed in Nebraska is white. That's not an insignificant part of the conversation in our country today. The crimes for which his life was taken today were perpetrated 39 years ago. So we're talking about crimes that are old for some people, but crimes with which people live every single day without their dad or without their son, without their spouse. And so this is going to reignite the conversation about capital punishment. It is going to stimulate conversations about whether or not we should ever carry out capital punishment. The Pope has recently determined that for Catholics and Catholic teaching, capital punishment shall never be considered just. It shall always be considered anathema. And so, if you're Catholic and the Pope has declared that, has said that, I'm wondering how you're feeling today. If you're also in Nebraska and you were a part of the effort in Nebraska to actually make capital punishment legal again. So it was like 3 years ago that Nebraska lawmakers actually abolished the death penalty. They did away with it. And then it was reinstated a couple of years ago through a citizen ballot initiative. Well, I'm now wondering if, you know, Catholics who voted in favor of the citizen ballot initiative in Nebraska to reinstitute the death penalty, you know, I think it puts us in a moral conflict when we have religious leaders like the Pope talk about things that are actually the purview of the state. And they're even the purview of the state when it comes to what Scripture says. So it's an interesting conversation. I'm not going to actually weigh in on one side of it or the other today, but I would like for us to begin a conversation about it. I think this is the kind of conversation that leads to discussions about the use of the American use of drones overseas to, frankly, assassinate people that we don't like. So when we talk about the ways in which we as Americans, through our government, either at the state level, through the execution of those who are guilty of capital crimes, or how we as a nation state use lethal force, deadly power in other places around the world to keep ourselves and others safe. It's an important conversation, like, because it's the taking of a life, and life is God's to give and God's to take away. You've heard me say on a number of occasions, I'm pro-life from conception to natural death. Well, what then do I do with the question of capital punishment? And let's start that conversation today. But let's have that be a conversation that we have as an ongoing part of our discourse here on Connecting Faith Over Time, because there are going to be lots of headlines related to such things. But there's a few other things that I want to be sure you are aware of, because they're going to be spiking in the news, I think, probably here pretty shortly. One of them is the story of a U.S. Army investigator. It's the story of a U.S. Army chaplain, Jerry Scott Squires, who refused to conduct a marriage retreat because a lesbian officer planned to attend. And so the marriage retreat was actually then not held by Army Chaplain Squires. He is endorsed by the Southern Baptist North American Mission Board and therefore does not affirm same-sex marriage. Now, following Army protocol, U.S. Army protocol, he is required to adhere to the tenets of his endorsing agency, which means that he could not actually lead a retreat on the subject of marriage in which two people who were not male and female, who intended to marry one another, would participate. And so he rescheduled the event, making the accommodation that it would be led by a chaplain of another expression of faith, probably a mainline chaplain, who does affirm same-sex marriage, and therefore the women, the lesbian couple, could participate. So that is going to be an ongoing and very public debate. The Army chaplain now faces 6 months in prison for not affirming this same-sex couple, even though he made accommodation for their participation by rescheduling the event and having it led by a chaplain who was able to affirm same-sex marriage. So I think that this is going to be an important conversation for us to have, not only about holy matrimony, what is marriage, but about sexuality, religious liberty, the military chain of command, and ultimately what is just. Are we actually going to begin compelling chaplains who are Southern Baptist and therefore required to adhere to their endorsing agency's views of things? Or are we going to compel them to bow the knee to a sexual agenda that says that, no, you have to actually leave your Christian beliefs at the door in order to be an Army chaplain, because here we're going to require you, compel you, we're going to compel you to affirm things that you don't affirm, as in his case, a Southern Baptist. All right, hey, let's take a quick break. When we come back, I want to update you on the situation in Turkey related to Andrew Brunson, who has been in prison there since 2016. Some developments in that story that I think will interest you. You are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. We'll be right back. Hey, friends, you're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBurge. Actually, my Andrew Brunson update is going to have to wait till the bottom of the hour because joining me now is Christina King. Christina is the African-American Affairs Director of the Philos Project. And we often talk to representatives of the Philos Project about what's going on in the Middle East. But today we're going to talk with Christina about issues right here in the United States and how how her experience, her studies, and her passion to see cooperation between Jews and African Americans is unfolding. So, Christina, welcome to Connecting Faith.
Thank you so much. I'm very glad to be with you today.
So we understand that you live in Chicago, and I want to get to that in a minute, because we have been, I think, like everybody that, you know, draws show topics from the headline news. We've obviously been concerned about the news headlines related to Chicago. And so I'll tee that up for a conversation in just a minute. But you have a particular passion to utilize the cooperation between Jews and African Americans that took place during the Civil Rights era, and using that to inspire cooperation today. I would love for you to just share with us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, it was the Civil Rights Movement, in my opinion. Other than perhaps the Civil War, was probably the most significant event that actually impacted every American's life, and the passage of civil rights legislation, and for myself as an African American, the way that it affected my own life, the school that I could go to, so I attended Duke University, and the jobs that I could have, and just everything about my life. Was impacted so much during the Civil Rights Movement. And the Civil Rights Movement was truly a climax in the relationship between the Black and Jewish communities in America. So you had a African-American Christian pastor in the person of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, who was a leader of the civil rights movement, along with many others. You had the foot soldiers, many in the African American community, and many other people of faith. But you had a very unique relationship personally between Dr. King and the Jewish community. You know that iconic photo that we always see where Dr. King is walking and there's a gentleman next to him with a white beard and white hair. Mm-hmm. And they're carrying the Torah. He's carrying the Torah scroll. And although in the movie Selma, they edited that out to be an Orthodox Greek priest, it was really Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel. And the Jewish community was 50% of the attorneys. They were 70% of the funding. We know significant events like with depicted in the Mississippi Burning movie where Goodman, Shaney, and Swarner, young people who were helping to have voters to register, were killed, where you had two Jewish young men and an African-American young man. And it was just that time. And so I learned about that. And as I began to study about it, and it was really just about 10 years ago. So even though I knew some of those pictures, I didn't truly understand the depth of that relationship. And even in my own work, most of us don't really know that history. We don't really understand the parallels between those two communities, but they certainly impacted the nation through the civil rights movement. And again, many other people of faith were a part of that movement, but there was a unique relationship between the Jewish and African-American community. And you can see that, it runs throughout American history.
So we're talking today with Christina King. She works with the Philos Project. Christina, for people who are listening and they know they've heard the name Abraham Heschel, but, you know, they're not quite as up to speed on all of this as you are. Can you remind us who Abraham Heschel is?
Yeah, so he was a very significant rabbi who was a great friend of Dr. King. He was very significant in the civil rights movement. There are many leaders and many rabbis in the during the civil rights movement, but specifically there's an iconic photo that many of us have seen where the two of them are walking across the bridge in Selma, Alabama during that march. And Rabbi Heschel was a great supporter of Dr. King and of the civil rights movement. You know, he spoke to his community and was a tremendous leader, tremendous thought leader. He was a Orthodox rabbi, and he was a tremendous leader in galvanizing the community during the civil rights movement, and a dear friend of Dr. King. So he was actually one of the only people who spoke at his funeral. And right before Dr. King passed away, Dr. King was supposed to be going to have Seder dinner with Rabbi Heschel and his family. And then, of course, he was assassinated right before Passover. So,
For Christians who are listening, they may also recognize that Abraham Heschel was the one who persuaded the Catholic Church to eliminate many, many passages in its liturgy that demeaned the Jews. I mean, he really, during this period of history, he really, we talk about people who really influenced the times in which they lived. And Abraham Heschel, he influenced not only the relationships, I think, among Americans related to race, but among Americans related to what I would say was religious persecution of the Jews at the time.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, there were many, significant rabbis. You know, I was at the Hebrew Union College in Cincinnati, and they have the American Jewish Archives there. And in those archives, they have some of these just beautiful pictures, but also the most amazing radio recordings, much like a program like this that they've kept, that they have in their archives, where many of the rabbis that were speaking to their congregations or speaking to the community about civil rights and social justice. And, you know, in the face of what was a very, you know, tense time in American history, and encouraging thought and encouraging, you know, they were speaking to the people and reasoning with the people to take a stance on certain issues. And, you know, I was there once at a conference that was filled with both African Americans and the Jewish community, and we were like just in tears to hear some of the messages and the context of some of the messages. You know, where people were standing up in such a time in American history. But you know, this, you know, the work that I'm privileged to do now with the Philos Project. So the Philos Project's work in positive Christian engagement in the Middle East, and specifically in my background with Israel, has been a fascinating historical journey into the relationship between the Black and Jewish communities. But it's also been very exciting to be a part of rekindling the relationship and bringing leaders from the African-American community to Israel. One of the main things that we're privileged to do is to bring pastors and other leaders to Israel and to share and introduce them to the Holy Land, to also talk about current issues and about a modern Israel. As your listeners might know, that the Philos Project is a partner with Passages Israel that brings just hundreds of college students and young leaders to Israel, to the Holy Land, and to make that connection both with their religious heritage, but also with a modern Israel. And so it's just been it's been amazing. It's been amazing response and place. You know, Israel can be such a place of a lightning rod place, but it's very interesting that it's also a place that very much brings people together.
Absolutely.
And especially people of faith.
Absolutely. It's the most tolerant people I've ever met in my whole life. Christina, we probably have like 1 minute left for our conversation today. So I'll pitch something to you. Are you going to see Black Klansmen this weekend?
I saw it the first day.
All right. So give us a 20-second thumbs up or thumbs down.
Thumbs up, thumbs jumping up. Everyone should see it. It's for everybody. We have to learn about our history to be able to do things different. We have to learn about all kinds of people to understand where they're coming from. It's such a privilege when you open your mind and you embrace the truth, as the truth will make us free. It's thumbs up.
All right, I love that. There you go, friends. A little movie recommendation from Christina King of the Philos Project. Christina, thank you so much for joining us today on Connecting Faith.
Thank you.
Hey, friends, I got to take a quick break, but next up, I'll fill you in on Andrew Brunson. You're listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. I have just been reminded by a listener that the bridge collapse in Genoa, Italy, resonates with listeners in the Twin Cities, that the 11th anniversary of the 35 West bridge collapse, which took place on August the 1st in 2007, just passed. And there were 11 people who lost their lives that day. When that span of Interstate 35 collapsed. And I guess I just so now I feel compelled to say to you, if you want to call and talk about that, if you want to call and talk about how you felt and where you were and how that makes you have a heart that grieves today with and for the people in Genoa, Italy, and how the world becomes very small when we share in one another's suffering, particularly through these kinds of experiences. I'd love to hear from you. So you can call me. The studio line is open, 877-933-2484. You can always text me at that same number, 877-933-2484. We'll just leave the phone lines open and see if anybody feels led to call or to text and reflect on those events and how you're feeling as, my listener information, now that I pull the story up, 13 people lost their lives in the bridge collapse, in the Twin Cities 11 years ago. So again, if that just resonates with you and you just want to weigh in and talk a little bit about it, the phone lines are open. 877-933-2484. I'm going to carry on and talk about some other things, but just know that if you give me a call or if you text, we'll bring you on, or we'll raise your concerns and be sure that people there's a little bit of never forget in all of this, right? I mean, I think that the 9/11 anniversary, although it sometimes now comes and goes when we don't pay much attention to it, the reality is we committed in that moment to never forget. And I think that when there is shared grief, the Challenger explosion, happened when I was in high school. And I actually, for whatever reason, we all went out into the parking lot and like watched the shuttle take off at that point. So on that day, right, I mean, it did not look like it normally looked. It was not just a streaking white thing. There was a big, massive white ball. Not very long into the flight. It's a shared grief. It's a shared experience. It's a point in time. And it's very public. And so if you want to process through some of that and talk about that and how it has affected you, or maybe lift up some prayers for the folks in Genoa dealing with those same kinds of tragic events today, just let you know the Connecting Faith phone lines are open, 877-933-2484. Okay, I've been telling you all hour that I'm going to give you an update on Andrew Brunson and the events unfolding in Turkey. So you may or may not be paying close attention to the collapse of the Turkish lira. That is the currency in Turkey. There's actually been a fair amount of reporting. Journalists are doing a really exceptional job on this front, I feel like. And so this one actually comes from the Religion News Service International Desk, and Umar Farouk is the author of this particular piece. And he's reporting in this piece about the witnesses who testified against U.S. Pastor Andrew Brunson in the trial. And so this is new information for many of us, because the identity of the witnesses had been protected. They were considered secret. And actually, we now know, this excellent reporting, that they were disgruntled members, former members of the church, and that the Turkish star witnesses against Andrew Brunson were actually expelled members of his own congregation. I want you to think about that for a moment. When he is sitting there, and those who are bringing false charges against him are people for whom he has sacrificed, people for whom he has served selflessly in a foreign land as an ambassador of the gospel of Jesus Christ for decades. I actually think it makes the wound that much more acute. I also suspect it makes it so much like the experience of Jesus that that as a Christian believer, Andrew would have been unable to see the connection between his experience and the experience of Christ, whose false accusers obviously Christ knew quite well. And so we want to continue praying about what's happening. When Andrew Brunson was released from a Turkish prison and remanded to house arrest, the expectation of those who are very close to the case was that he was actually going to be expelled from the country, that he was going to be deported. That did not happen, because the United States was unwilling to swap a person who the Turks want back on their soil. And so although this reporting includes that Andrew tried to reconcile with those who have caused division in the congregation, the accusations related to his involvement in the attempt to overthrow the Turkish government in 2016. Those accusations have continued to mount, I think is the way to say it. They're all false, but they continue to mount. I think that it'll be interesting for everyone to know weekly worship services actually continue at the Resurrection Church in Ismar. A group of Turkish and American pastors, along with Andrew Brunson's wife, Noreen, continue to lead the service in Turkish. It's much like worship here would be. Keyboards, a piano, a guitar, the singing of hymns, and the proclamation of the Word of God. They also pray for an end to the U.S.-Turkey tensions. They pray for God to protect Turkey and the Turkish government each week when they gather for worship, in much the same way that you and I would ask for those same kinds of prayers in the places where we live and worship. Okay, I have a text from a listener here. It says, we're from Sioux Falls, South Dakota. We were headed to Duluth for vacation. We had gone over the Twin Bridge just minutes before. And talking to my oldest son, who is a trucker, who was going the other direction over the bridge. Uh-oh, I better open this up and see if there's more. Just minutes before the collapse. This listener says, God spared us. And I think, my friends, there are so many occasions upon which we can look not very far back, and we can see God's protection. And I know that as soon as we say that, there's grief to imagine that God did not then protect those 13 who perished on that day, or that God did not protect the now more than 25 in Genoa, or those who died in the collapse of the Skyway Bridge when I was a teenager. And so I don't think that we can pretend to know the mind of God in all of the matters of our day. But we're gonna rejoice with those who rejoice. We're absolutely gonna give God the glory for protecting us in those circumstances. And then we're not gonna live with survivor guilt. We're going to live with survivor responsibility. We're gonna live with joy. We're going to live with purpose. We're going to live intentionally before God and for God. And so just want to say thank you to this listener from Sioux Falls sharing their experience of that particular day when the Twin Bridge collapsed in on the western span of Interstate 35, 11 years ago now. Even as we continue to pray for the first responders who are seeking to identify hopefully still some survivors in the collapse of the bridge in Genoa. The pictures of it are pretty amazing. I'm trying to think of a land bridge in America that is quite so long and wide as the one that we're seeing pictures of in the story from Italy today. I think of bridges as being over water, but this is actually a bridge that appears to, at least the part that collapsed, appears to be over land. And so be, you know, quite interested as time goes on. We will all learn more. There will be lots of reporting, I am sure. One more quick story before we have to take our final break, and then we'll make the connecting point for today. One more quick story, and that is... that is related again to marriage. I don't know how else to say this, but there's a story in The Guardian, and The Guardian is a European paper, and it's entitled "What God Has Not Joined Together." Oh, what God has not joined together: the rise of the humanist wedding. Secular marriages are now the most popular in Scotland, prompting fresh calls for reform. And so they walk down the aisle. They have maids of honor. They have a best man. Pipers play. But there's no priest. There's no minister. There's no registrar to lead the ceremony. Like thousands of Scots, these two were legally married by a humanist celebrant. For the first time, it became actually the most popular marriage ceremony in the country. And so what we're talking here are about people who want the appearance of a wedding, of a traditional wedding, The innocence of a white gown, even though I don't think anybody in these conversations is talking about sexual purity until the wedding night. They're not talking about a first experience of consummation on the honeymoon. That's not what's going on here. They wanted something that would be personal, and they wanted it to look religious, but not be religious. And just think about that for just a moment. There's an aching in the human heart. I just think there's no question that, you know, we're spiritual beings. And so we ache for significant evidences that we're making life passages. We yearn for ways in which the everyday can be connected to what you and I recognize as eternal. I have no idea how a humanist is processing that, because there is no connection to anything eternal, because it's the only thing that matters is the matter, is the natural world. There is nothing supernatural. And so it's actually long form piece of journalism talking about the rise of humanist marriages in England and Wales. But the fact that neither one of these countries actually recognizes humanist weddings. Now, obviously, they have them, and these people are cohabitating. These people are living as married people. They have had a service, but these are actually unauthorized services. So the Roman Catholic Church conducted a little over 1,100 marriages in Scotland last year. But in 1961, the Roman Catholic Church conducted 7,000 marriages in Scotland. So when you think about the decline of church attendance in 2016, only a little, barely over 7% of the Scottish people actually went to church, and a large majority of those are over 65. So marriage rates have fallen in England and Wales. Church attendance has fallen in England and Wales, and yet people still want to get married. And so this humanist trend is on the rise. And I think at some point, you know, not only as a nation, but the church in those countries is going to have to find something to say about it. They're going to have to find something to do. And we would not prefer, it would not be preferable for the Church of Scotland or the Church of England to sell religious marriages, which is actually the approach that the Church of England has now taken. You can buy a religious marriage, and therefore an authorized marriage service, if you live in England, at yourchurchwedding.org. Yes, seriously. I mean, I everything is commodified now, and marriage shouldn't be. It's holy matrimony. It is what God actually does among human beings in order that we might have an institution that points to the eternal reality of the relationship of Christ with his church. And so it's not something to play around with. It's not something to trivialize. It's certainly not something to turn into a revenue stream for the church, which tends to be what happens. Okay, so I got to take one more quick break. When we come back, I'm going to be making the connecting point. We're going to talk about the shooter in Sutherland Springs. We're going to talk about his wife, and we're going to talk about redemption and the church of which she is now a part. I'm Carmen LaBerge. You're listening to Connecting Faith. Hey, friends, you are listening to Connecting Faith. I'm your host, Carmen LaBerge. We're going to turn our attention here for the connecting point portion of the program to the experience of a young woman named Danielle Kelly. Her husband was Devin Kelly. Now, if that name does not sound familiar to you, it's because following the massacre at a church in Sutherland Springs, Texas, in November of 2017, November 5th of 2017, the media intentionally didn't say his name, which I completely and totally understand. But his name is a name that this young woman took in marriage. And she says, you know, I fell in love with a boy who was not this person who did these things. He's the father of my children. They bear his name. I bear his name. I took his name. And I'm trying to reconcile the reality of my marriage vows, of the fact that he's the father of my children and always will be, with the reality that he's also a person who savagely took the lives of many people at the Sutherland Springs Church. She has given a series of interviews to the newspaper in San Antonio, and they have aggregated those interviews into what's called long-form journalism. So it's a very long article called The Gunman's Wife, and the byline is Sylvia Foster Frau, and in it we have aggregated together her experience of that day. And so, you know, I won't tell you everything about her story, but suffice it to say that there were red flags throughout their life together. There were certainly moments in time when you will read this and say to yourself, there has to be a better way for us to deal with people who are this obviously broken and have so many demons. She talks about that in her conversation with the journalist. She talks about the fact that we all have our demons. And I think that when we read that language, when we hear that language, as Christians, that's one of the places where we need to engage the spiritual language that's being offered. That's not language that you and I are introducing into the conversation. That is language that the wife of the gunman is introducing into the conversation. And so I think we have to take that seriously, and we have to be prepared to talk about the reality of spiritual warfare. And we have to be prepared to talk about what, you know, the Bible actually bears witness to the reality of forces of evil among us. Now, did the devil make him do it? Absolutely not. We all live with the responsibility of our actions, and we are held to account and responsible for that which we take in our hands to do. And so when Danielle says that 9 months after the massacre, she still struggles to reconcile her grief at losing her son, losing her husband, at her piercing grief over the devastation that he caused. And she wavers between a desire to, like, defend him. and so I think that when we think about the complexity of the experience that people are having, I want you to think about the complexity of this young woman's experience. She's only 23. She's got two little boys to raise. And they have a dad, and she has a husband who is responsible for one of the deadliest mass shootings in American history. I know that the moms from Columbine have talked at length, but they didn't do so this soon after the experience. And so I think that one of the things that we have here in the words of Danielle Kelly is a fresh testimony. You know, how do you just start hanging out again with your friends? How do you start living again? Kids are pretty resilient, and people who suffer abuse as children often find themselves in abusive relationships. And that is certainly the testimony of this young woman. And so now we have a widow and two orphans. How do we as Christians respond to that? She's a vulnerable person. She experienced abuse when she was a child, and she continued to experience abuse as a wife. And the church is being the church. And I think that is what I want to lift up from this story. I think I want to lift up the ways in which the church is being the church in very positive and beautiful ways. And I want you to celebrate the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs. Danielle was a child, at least in some ways, of that church. And so her mother-in-law, his mother-in-law, her mother, continued to worship there. And so that is, I think, understood to be the provocation of why he chose that particular church. And so when we think about how the people of God can respond to a widow and her two orphan children, and how we might be tempted to hold her or hold them somehow responsible for what happened in that church on that day and the horrific experiences that those people and those children now live with. And Danielle responds this way: if I could take everything, all of their pain, and hold it on my own, I would, so nobody else would have to hurt. If it was only me that could have died and everybody else could have lived, I would have gladly taken that. Now, I want you to ask yourself for just a moment, what does that sound like to you? Because that sounds to me like Christ. And I'm not suggesting that in any way, shape, or form that Danielle is a Christ figure in all of this. What I'm trying to help us see and understand is that in the aftermath of events like Sutherland Springs, there are real people who need real opportunities for genuine reconciliation and redemption. And even though Danielle loved many of the people who died in that church, because they were her friends, they were members of her community. Out of respect for their grief, she did not attend their funerals. And yet she had a real need. She had a real need to talk with and be reconciled with survivors. And so that's what the rest of this article, The Gunman's Wife, chronicles. And there is a photograph of Danielle Kelly holding her daughter, Riley, talking with Chris Workman, who is a young man who was paralyzed by a shot that was fired by Danielle's husband. And so after Danielle visited, she's attending the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs. The first time that she visited was in June. And so what we're talking about here is a reconciliation, is a redemption that is happening right now. Happening right now. And I just want us to be mindful of this. I want us to be praying about this. I want us to be celebrating the witness of the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs, Texas. I want us to grieve. I want us to continue to grieve with those families who are grieving. Because those who died, died. But those who were shot and are paralyzed are now going to live, live here with those wounds forever. And those wounds are not just physical. There can be a paralysis of spirit. There can be a paralysis of relationship. There can be a paralysis of faith. And I just want to celebrate the redemptive power of God that is just flowing so freely through the First Baptist Church of Sutherland Springs, Texas. And I wanted you to know about it, and I want you to be praying for them. And then I want each and every one of us to go out there and do likewise. All right, friends, that's about all the time we have got today. I have a special treat for us tomorrow. We're going to be talking with Mark Middleberg about... you're familiar with the Case for Christ, but have you ever thought about how you personally can make the case for Christ? And so that's what he and I are going to talk about. And there's a study guide and a movie to help you do that. And so we're going to have that conversation tomorrow here on Connecting Faith. Friends, thank you as always for joining me. If you've got feedback, email me, Carmen@myfaithradio.com. Have a great day and God bless. Thanks for listening to this conversation from Connecting Faith. These podcasts are available because of listener support. You can make a gift now at myfaithradio.com. And thanks for sharing this audio link with a friend to grow the impact of connecting faith. Also, take a moment to subscribe to the podcast today at iTunes or your podcast player and never miss a conversation.